The headlines this hour. Iran's leader says the Islamic Republic is constantly engaged in challenges with world powers since it has disrupted equations of the hegemonic system. Palestinians attend a funeral for a teenager who was shot dead by Israeli soldiers in the occupied West Bank this morning. Also coming up, a much-anticipated report about the so-called Partygate scandal in the UK says that this country's senior leadership must bear responsibility for this culture.
Welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says that Iran has firmly stood against hostilities and enmities and continues to make progress. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the comments in a meeting with Iranian lawmakers. The leader said that Iran and world powers are engaged in constant challenges in various dimensions because the Islamic Republic's new model, which is religious democracy, led to the disruption of the global hegemonic system. Ayatollah Khamenei also raised the alarm about the hostile stance of world powers and threats of those possessing atomic weapons against each other. He added that Europe is one of the most war-prone regions that witnesses increasing military provocations and war in its vicinity. Ayatollah Khamenei said such conditions, in addition to food shortages and an unprecedented spread of a disease, have made the situation more complicated for other countries. Fuad Izadi is a professor of international studies at the University of Tehran who joins us. Welcome. So let's try to embrace and at the same time grasp what Iran's leader has said. And one of the interesting things here is the way that world powers are more prone in terms of, provoking wars vis-a-vis in Europe, which is more prone, I should say, in that respect, is more prone to that. Tell us what exactly, if you can break that down for us and what he means there exactly.
You know, Ayatollah Khamenei has been talking about the war in Europe a number of times as in the last 3 months or so. And the basic idea that he's presenting is that Iran is against war in general. Iran is a victim of an aggression from outside the country in the 1980s. At the same time, he realizes why these wars happen. He has said, both in this speech and in previous speeches, that the U.S. expansionist policies are responsible for what we see in Europe today. It seems that the United States is not interested in ending this war. And he has talked about the fact that the U.S. government lives on crisis, creating crisis and then benefiting from crisis and then feeding from crisis. And this has continued. Obviously, Europe has a history of wars, maybe more than other places in the world when you compare. And it seems that Europe is going back to that history. The world is changing. As you mentioned, this speech was given to the members of the Iranian parliament. So the people who have to make laws and monitor the executive branch are present, and they have a responsibility to make sure that in this very uncertain time, what's going on outside Iran is not going to affect the country negatively. So what Ayatollah Khamenei is doing is presenting his views about the history of the current conflict and also the fact that the U.S. government is causing difficulties in our part of the world, in Southeast Asia, is basically doing the same in Europe.
Well, what also we have said in our headline here, which I'd like for you to explain that a little bit more for us, is the fact that Iran's leader has said that the Islamic Republic is constantly engaged in challenges with world powers, and as a result, it has disrupted equations of what we've termed the hegemonic system. If we have disrupted that, does that mean that they have changed the way that they approach particularly Iran, but if not the region? And how can we be shielded against any actions that they may take, in particular, obviously, the U.S. against us?
You know, after World War II, as you know, we had a bipolar system of governance. We had the Eastern Bloc, we had the Western Bloc. After the fall of the Soviet Union, some people in the United States claim that we are in a unipolar world, and the U.S. is that hegemonic power. Nowadays, we have even the U.S. intelligence community in their February 2022 report, in that Global Trends 2030 reports that the National Intelligence Council published some time ago, are basically confessing that the hegemonic power of the United States is ending, confessing that the world is moving towards a multipolar world. And I think this is what Ayatollah Khamenei also believes, that we are in a historic turn in the last number of years. And why has the United States not been able to keep its hegemony? You know, the bipolar world lasted for 45 years. Why didn't the U.S. hegemonic unipolar world did not last for 45 years? Some people believe that even if that unipolar world was created, it ended sometime in 2005 or 2006. And the answer to that question is what Iran has done. So Iran has made sure that U.S. hegemony in Southwest Asia doesn't take root. Iran has been opposing U.S. aggressive policies in this part of the world. And that opposition that Iran has been engaging in has affected U.S. stance internationally. And it has contributed to the decline that we see in the United States. That has resulted in the fact that U.S. Has failed in its policies in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Afghanistan, in Yemen, no matter where, in Iran, no matter where you look, the U.S. has failed. And that failure in this part of the world, I think, has resulted in people realizing that the U.S. is no longer a hegemonic power, if we accept that U.S. was a hegemonic power sometime in the past. And that's why Iran has played an important role in making sure that the U.S. hegemony internationally has ended and will not be able to revive itself.
Pleasure. Thank you so much for that. Fuad Izzati, Professor of International Studies at the University of Tehran. Many thanks. Moving on, Palestinians hold a funeral for a teenager who was shot dead by Israeli forces near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus earlier in the day. Sixteen-year-old Gaith Rafiq Yamin was shot in the head and pronounced dead minutes later. It happened during confrontations that erupted after hundreds of settlers stormed the tomb of Prophet Joseph in Nablus under the protection of the Israeli army. At least 80 Palestinians were also injured during the attacks. Hamas resistance movement has blamed Israel for the escalation of tensions in the West Bank. Separately, the Palestinian Authority has urged the international community to break its silence and to provide protection to Palestinians, especially children, who are targeted by Israeli gunfire on an almost daily basis. Over a week into the tragic death of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akhle, Israel refuses to accept responsibility for her killing. Another Palestinian reporter, who was next to Abu Akhle when she was shot, says that the regime deliberately targeted her to silence journalists. In an interview with Press TV, Shatha Hanaisha dismissed claims by Israel that the veteran Al Jazeera Arabic journalist might have been hit by Palestinian fire. Hanaisha says that Israeli troops killed Abu Akhle to stop media coverage of the regime's crimes. Hanaisha said that since Israel seeks to evade accountability, it will not allow an independent investigation into Abu Akhle's killing. She said it is a regular thing with Israeli forces to kill Palestinians and to get away with it as nobody bothers to hold them to account. Abu Akhle was killed by covering a raid by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin earlier this month. She is widely believed to be killed by Israeli forces. The Associated Press said Tuesday its own investigation supports assertions that bullet that killed her came from an Israeli gun. But the regime says its own investigation has not determined that narrative. Israel says even if that is the case, it does not appear that the soldier who fired his gun will stand guilty of criminal misconduct. A Palestinian official says the Israeli atrocities have grown to such an extent that indicate the regime only understands the language of force. According to Gaza's governor, Ibrahim Abu al-Najah, Palestinians will not remain silent and will continue their struggle against the occupying regime. Al-Najah also condemned the regime's expansion of illegal settlements, stressing that Palestinians will not cede a single inch of their territory. He said that Israel is working on plans to expel the remaining Palestinians from the territories. But he noted the Palestinian people today are determined to reclaim their land and return to their homes more than ever before. Al-Najah added that Palestinians will not resume the futile negotiations with Israel, despite pressure from the outside. Israel has been conducting a violent campaign of aggression against Palestinians in recent months. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has held a military parade to mark the 22nd anniversary of the liberation of southern Lebanon from the Israeli occupation. Hezbollah fighters paraded in Baalbek City in the country's eastern Baqa Valley. Lebanon marks the Resistance and Liberation Day on May 25th each year. Hezbollah drove Israeli forces out of southern Lebanon in May 2000, ending over two decades of occupation. Since then, the resistance group has grown into a powerful military force, dealing repeated blows to the Israeli military, including during a 33-day war in 2006. The Hezbollah leader, Seyed Hassan Nasrallah, will deliver a speech on the occasion later today. The British Prime Minister is in hot water again over COVID lockdown breaking parties. Long-awaited official report blames Boris Johnson and his government for the partygate culture. The report by Sue Gray, a senior civil servant, says the leadership and top officials must bear responsibility for violating COVID rules. The report probed 16 such events held in Whitehall and Downing Street while the country was placed under strict lockdown in 2020 at the height of the pandemic. Moments after the report was published, Johnson, addressing Parliament, said that he takes full responsibility for what had happened.
And I want to begin today by renewing my apology to the House, to the whole country, for the short lunchtime gathering on the 19th of June 2020 in the Cabinet Room, during which I stood at my place at the Cabinet table and for which I received a fixed penalty notice. And I also want to say, Mr. Speaker, above all, that I take full responsibility for everything that took place on my watch.
The Premier also said that he was humbled and learned his lesson, but he insisted he was surprised and disappointed over drink-fueled events. That is while new revelations show that Johnson himself attended a booze-filled party at his office, adding to the calls for him to resign. The opposition Labour Party leader has lashed out at the Prime Minister. Keir Starmer says the report would stand as a monument to the, quote, hubris and arrogance of Johnson's government. He censured the government for flouting the COVID lockdown rules. North Korea ramps up its missile test, reportedly firing several short- and long-range projectiles in a single day amid heightened tensions on the Korean Peninsula. South Korea and Japan say that three missiles, including one that appeared to be an ICBM, were fired in the early hours of Wednesday. Seoul and Tokyo have called the launches provocative. South Korea's military says it has, in response, held a joint drill with American forces without giving any details. North Korea has conducted a flurry of missile tests, including its largest ICBM this year. The launches happened just a day after U.S. President Joe Biden wrapped up his Asia trip, during which he agreed to new measures to deter the nuclear-armed North. The White House official said that Biden has been briefed on the latest launches. Meanwhile, the South Korean defense chief has, in a phone call with his U.S. counterpart, called for an early deployment of American strategic assets in his country. A correspondent in Seoul, Frank Smith, explains why exactly North Korea keeps working on its missile technology, despite all the denuclearization talks from the U.S.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un promised then-president of the United States, Donald Trump, that Pyongyang would refrain from long-range missile testing and nuclear testing so long as the U.S. dropped its hostile policy. Really, the U.S. didn't come forward with any negotiations with North Korea, kept North Korea under United Nations Security Council sanctions. North Korea then sort of gave perhaps the Biden administration a bit of time to come forward, and now with the conservative Yoon Suk-yeol government here in the South, we can see that patience really has kind of run out from the North, with analysts suggesting now North Korea really isn't going to look for any sort of denuclearization talks, but is likely to maintain a nuclear deterrence against what it sees as U.S. aggression.
The Ukrainian lawmaker says Russian forces are seeking to encircle Ukrainian troops in twin eastern cities from three directions in an attempt to control the Donbas region. This as the war between the two neighbors now drags into its fourth month. Musa Mogomedov says that Russian forces keep bombing Severodonetsk and Lysychansk in Donetsk and Luhansk provinces in totally inhumane fashion. He says the attacks are causing civilian deaths. Ukraine's military general staff has also said that Russia is using aircraft to support its ground forces. Earlier, President Volodymyr Zelensky warned that Moscow is seeking to destroy the industrial Donbas region, where it has now focused its attacks. The Russian Defense Ministry did not immediately respond to the allegations. On Tuesday, the Russian Defense Minister, however, said that Moscow is deliberately slowing its offensive to allow civilians to evacuate. Russian forces have already taken control of three towns in the Donetsk region, including Svitlodarsk.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. UK ministers remain unable to decide on ways to relieve poverty as they wrangle over windfall tax for energy companies. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written jointly by Heather Stewart and Gwen Tufam under the heading Boris Johnson to stress work as the fix for cost of living crisis. Please stay with us to hear more about the story. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson hopes to blunt calls for urgent action on the cost of living crisis by stressing that work is the best route out of poverty, as ministers continue wrangling about the merits of a windfall tax. Number 10 sources confirmed recently that the Prime Minister will continue to throw the spotlight on the healthy state of the job market in the face of the rising clamour to purportedly help families struggling with their bills. Ministers have as yet been unable to agree what more should be done to help, with Downing Street keen to stress £22 billion that has already been spent on supporting households and highlight the need to grow the economy. Johnson told the Welsh Conservative Conference on Friday, May 20th, "I'm proud to say that you have to go all the way back to 1974 to find a time when the unemployment was as low in the UK as it is today. And whatever the difficulties that the post-COVID economy faces now, I just want you to dwell on that for a second." However, with wages failing to keep up with 9% annual inflation, many of those struggling to make ends meet are already in jobs. Official figures show that 41% of universal credit claimants are in work, while the Joseph Rowntree Foundation calculates that 68% of families living in poverty include at least one working adult. The Liberal Democrats' economy spokesperson, Christine Jardine, said hardworking families across the UK are really struggling right now as the price of everything from food to fuel continues to rise. Yet the Conservatives are doing little to help. She said many people were juggling long hours and multiple jobs just to scrape by. With Parliament breaking for the Whitsun recess on Thursday, May 26, any fresh package of measures to help households cope with surging inflation is now not expected until June 6 at the earliest. The Treasury says the Chancellor Rishi Sunak is awaiting more details of how sharply energy bills are likely to rise in the autumn. Michael Lewis, the chief executive of E.ON, Britain's biggest energy supplier, said on Sunday, May 22, that 1 in 8 of its customers were already in arrears. Speaking on BBC One Sunday's morning show, Louis said, "I read emails from customers regularly, I listen in on calls, and frankly, some people are at the edge. They simply cannot pay, and that will get worse." The price cap for consumer bills had a record rise last month from £1,277 to £1,971 a year and is expected to rise to at least £2,600 in October, and Louis said it could even hit £3,000. He said it's a very, very significant impact. "That's why we've called upon the government to take more action. We do need more intervention in October, and it has to be very substantial." The former Treasury Minister Jess Norman became the latest senior Conservative to support a one-off levy on the profits of oil and gas firms on Sunday, May 22, claiming such a policy ethically principled and pragmatic. However, several cabinet ministers, including the business secretary Kwasi Kwarteng and the Brexit Opportunities Minister Jacob Rees-Mogg, have made clear their objections in public. Rees-Mogg warned against the idea that business was a honeypot that you can just raid whenever you feel like. In an unusual show of disunity, others, including the Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, have lodged a public plea for lower taxes. Truss said a low-tax economy was the way to tackle the crisis at a time when taxes have been rising. Sunak has not ruled out a windfall tax, which polling suggests would be popular with the public, insisting all options remain on the table. It is understood one proposal under consideration is a taper tax that would fall less heavily on firms that invest, though number 10 sources suggested it had not yet been discussed with the Prime Minister. Johnson and Sunak have been meeting regularly to thrash out a set of policies, but have not yet decided whether to stick to the targeted measures to help the poorest families or include costlier across-the-board proposals. These could include a value-added tax, VAT cut, or bringing forward the income tax cut that Sunak has planned for 2024. Ministers have consistently struggled to respond to the question of what more the UK government will do to supposedly help households, after the Chancellor's spring statement was widely regarded as inadequate. A string of Tory backbenchers from across the party have called on the government to do more, including Northern Research Group Chair Jake Berry, the Committee Chair Bernard Jenkin, and the Education Committee Chair Robert Halfen.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alamin. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are currently observing the third sermon so as to grasp some of the details regarding the wisdom behind Imam Ali alayhi salam's governance. We came across this statement where Imam Ali alayhi salam talks about the Mariqeen, a group of people called the Khawarij, and he says that the moment Imam Ali alayhi salam began his movement, first there was a group that broke their promises, and then there was a group that left the religion, and basically these were the Khawarij, who, because of their weak understanding, unfortunately, they caused a lot of problems to Imam Ali alayhi salam, and they placed many hurdles on the path of truth and true governance. And that's why Imam Ali alayhi salam says, نَكَثَتْ طَائِفَةٌ وَمَرَقَتْ أُخْرَى. He complains, he said, one group broke their promises and another group, they left the religion swiftly. They thought they were religious, they assumed that they were pious and good, but unfortunately their hearts were blind.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Oh.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to IRIB English Radio. We're talking about this group of people called the Mariqin, the Khawarij. Yes, this group were religious, holy, seemingly holy, believing, seemingly believing, morally upright, apparently. They would beseech to Allah in the middle of the nights. They would cry and weep to God. But unfortunately, they were weak-minded, ignorant, foolish, and crooked in their thinking. They were biased. They were fundamentalists without thought. If there is a fundamentalist person but has thought, then apparently, that's a very good thing. We should be fundamentalists. We should have good fundamentals which we stick to and adhere to. But if that is without thought and understanding, then that can be very dangerous. That form of submissiveness is rather a dangerous thing that can destroy a person. And that is why in another place Imam Ali alayhi salam says, in another section of his words, he says, Al-Muta'abbid بغير علم كحمار الطاحونة, that a submissive person, a subservient person, a person who worships but without knowledge is like a donkey that turns around a grinding machine. كحمار الطاحونة, in the olden days they would take the grinding machine, there would be some stones that would grind, the wheat, and the there would be a stone on top and a stone below, and they would all be circular in shape. The stone on top would have a stick connected to it, like a pole connected to it, and that pole would be connected to an animal like a donkey, and then they would close the eyes of the donkey and they would make the donkey walk. They would drive the donkey. And the donkey would continuously walk in circles. And as the donkey would walk in circles, he would push the pole, and the pole would turn the rock that was on top. The rock that was lying on top of the other rock. And as it would turn, it would cause a grinding effect to happen, and therefore they would make flour in that way. So Imam Ali alayhi salam says, the one who worships without thinking is like this donkey who is used to turn around the pivot of this grinding machine.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are talking about this group called the Mariqin or the Khawarij. And Imam Ali alayhi salam, he compares these people to a donkey that is whose eyes are closed, and whose eyes have been closed by a cloth, let's say, and he's just turning around in circles, trying to push that grinding machine, as I explained in the previous segment. Now, this poor donkey, right, if he would be left to walk in a straight line, he would have probably traversed from Medina, let's say, in Arabia, passed by Iraq, and all the cities there, and into Baghdad and Samarkand, into Iran, and maybe would have reached China. But poor guy, because his eyes have been closed, and he's walking around in circles. When the animal is stopped after 6 months, and the cloth is opened from his eyes, he realizes that he is returned back to square one, and he's not gone forward. Why? Because he's a person who is worshipping, who is moving. He thinks he's moving, but he's moving around in circles because he doesn't have insight. he doesn't see ahead. But instead, if there's a person who has got insight and knowledge, a person who, when he wants to worship and become submissive to a certain, ideology, he gives it thought, understanding, he goes into it with insight and research, and firmly accepts that methodology and that teaching and that religion with his intellect, then that one is like a man or like a horse who knows his direction and is firm in reaching that direction. And it goes so fast and reaches that direction. That is how. So that is why we need to be very careful that whenever we want to accept a certain ideology or a thinking, then we need to really give it thought and understanding before taking rash steps. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معنا باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمنى هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
There are longer-term solutions to solving the world's ongoing refugee crises, such as addressing the root causes that endanger people's lives and livelihoods. But a fundamental principle of any morally functioning government is to uphold the human rights of people to seek safety, and not shift that responsibility to states with less developed asylum systems. Here we present you an article in this regard, written by Joshua Surtees, a journalist and former writer for UNHCR, under the heading, "Rich Britain Sending Refugees to Rwanda Isn't Burden Sharing, It's shameful exploitation. Please stay with us to hear more about the story. Joshua Surtees wrote, "In my time working for the Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, a stark fact was often mentioned. The vast majority of the world's displaced people are hosted by the world's poorest countries. Today, 85% of the refugees live in developing countries, while the richest nations host just 15%. While Rwanda might be developing economically, it is still among the world's 25 poorest countries. The UK is among the world's 10 richest countries. To acknowledge the disparity of wealth between the two nations and decide that Rwanda is better able to accommodate people attempting the treacherous journey across the channel takes a huge leap of the imagination." The deal announced by UK Home Secretary Priti Patel in Kigali on Thursday, April 14th, demonstrates the government's tenacious commitment to positioning Britain as a country that is close to the world and to those who need its sanctuary the most. There has been a great deal of political debate and condemnation since the policy was announced, and the government arranged for the arrival in Rwanda of the British media it thought best placed to help it trumpet this maneuver in time for the local elections. But there are still questions we must ask to ascertain whether this is a cynical ploy or a thought-through policy. Joshua Surtees said, "Is it because Rwanda has more geographic capacity, perhaps? More free land or housing infrastructure? Is Britain really bursting at the seams? Rwanda's population density is almost double that of Britain's. It is a country almost twice as crowded as ours, yet, per capita, it already hosts five times as many refugees as the UK, as well as hosting Congolese and Burundian refugees. Rwanda has recently offered itself as a host country for the emergency evacuation of refugees trapped in dire conditions in Libya." In the introduction to the Home Office's Memorandum of Understanding with Rwanda, the UK boasts of having taken in 25,000 Syrian refugees as a way of demonstrating its long, proud history of providing protection to those who need it. This claim is laughable. More than 6 million Syrians have fled their country in the 11 years since war began. For much of the crisis, Lebanon hosted 2 million Syrians, representing a third of Lebanon's 6 million population. Bangladesh, one of the world's most densely populated countries, hosts close to 1 million Rohingya refugees from Myanmar. Poland is currently hosting 2.7 million Ukrainians. These figures put in context what it really means to protect those in need. The memorandum speaks of burden sharing during refugee crises. Rwanda, a country that has experienced its fair share of crises, is already shouldering its share of the burden. The UK comfortably has the capacity to take in people crossing the channel. It is neglecting its share of the burden while persuading Rwanda to carry more. How the Home Secretary managed to convince the Rwandan government to accept this arrangement may become apparent in due course. When Australia utilized the tiny island state of Nauru for a similar purpose, it gave aid in return. Australia, an immensely privileged country, effectively paid a less economically fortunate country to take desperate people off its hands, in some cases for years. The British government is callously copying the Australian playbook. While its PR agents in the press trumpet this coup as some kind of triumph, the Daily Mail's front page read, "Rwanda plan to smash the Channel gangs." The Daily Express said, "Bold plan to send both migrants to Rwanda," as though the Prime Minister had overseen a selfless act of reason, humanity, bravery, striking a blow for compassion, saving England from the scourge of people simply trying to escape death and poverty. When Boris Johnson referred in his speech on Thursday, April 14th, to people illegally entering the country, he was using the worst kind of semantics. Refugees fleeing the conflicts or persecution do not have the luxury of entering Britain legally. If they had the time and opportunity to apply for a UK visa, they would not, in essence, be refugees. Seeking asylum routinely involves entering a territory without prior permission. When UNHCR's Asia and Pacific Director, Enrica Ratawat, visited Nauru in 2018, he reported his shock at the immense toll that long-term detention had taken on people's mental health. Over 80% had been diagnosed with PTSD, trauma, and depression. He told the press the sense of hopelessness and despair was extremely tangible. In Greece, in 2020, asylum seekers living at Moria Reception Center on the island of Lesbos burnt it down in what was perceived by many as a protest at the poor conditions and dangerous levels of overcrowding. We should not automatically assume that Rwanda's model of hosting asylum seekers will follow that of Lesbos of Nauru. Indeed, there are some good news stories about refugee integration there. But Rwanda, which Johnson describes as one of the world's safest countries, is also a country that cannot provide an acceptable life conditions for its citizens because it is one of the world's poorest countries. What guarantees can we have that non-citizens will be well received? Rwanda has internal transit centers where people deemed undesirable, including beggars, are sent in order to keep the streets looking appealing for tourists attracted by the country's international marketing campaigns. Rwandans who oppose or criticize the government are liable to be informed on by neighbors, placed under surveillance, blackmailed, tortured, sent to rehabilitation camps, or even killed. Many Rwandans were forcibly returned to the country from refugee camps in neighboring countries in the years after the 1994 genocide. Many continue to risk their lives or liberty to trek through remote jungles to escape and flee to Uganda as refugees themselves. In reporting Patel and Johnson's plan, the Daily Telegraph said that migrants will be encouraged to settle in Rwanda. The agreement doesn't appear to give them much choice in the matter. Their options, should Rwanda not turn out to be a safe or sustainable place for them, will be somewhat limited. The memorandum says Rwanda will ensure that it will treat each relocated individual and process their claim for asylum in accordance with the Refugee Convention. But what about the UK's obligations to abide by the convention that it is a signatory to? What about that claimed long and proud history of protection? UNHCR, the organization designed to uphold the convention, has said it will delay its judgment on the legality of Patel's deal until its legal teams in Geneva have analyzed the details. Though, its position is clear. It said in a statement, UNHCR does not support the outsourcing of asylum states' obligations. There are longer-term solutions to solving the world's ongoing refugee crisis, such as addressing the root causes that endanger people's lives and livelihoods. But a fundamental principle of any morally functioning government is to uphold the human rights of people to seek safety, and not shift that responsibility to states with less developed asylum systems.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, Hadith of the Day, here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a hadith and a narration which has been transmitted from Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. And this tradition is about the etiquettes of journeying and traveling This tradition is actually a hadith which Imam Sadiq alayhi salam narrates from the sage Luqman, who has been mentioned in the Holy Quran. Of course, he is not a prophet, but he is considered a friend of God, one of the awliya, and also one of the wise people. He's known as Luqman al-Hakim. The Quran quotes him and the advice that he gave his son. So in this tradition, the Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says that Luqman said the following to his son. Right, so this is part of the advice that Luqman gave to his son, but it hasn't been narrated in the Quran. Luqman said, "When you travel in the company of people, consult with them frequently about each of your affairs." So you see, you're going on a journey with a group of people, your friends or your family, right? Consult with them. Let's say that you stop, to rest, and you want to go get something to eat for, the people traveling, right? Yeah, at least ask them about what they want or what would be best for them. Don't just go and make a decision yourself. Right? Consult with them because you're traveling with them. They're important. It's important to consult with them before you make a decision about the journey. Then Luqman said, "Make them smile often." Make them smile often, meaning be jovial with them, joke with them, make them smile, be happy with them, be kind to them and make them happy. And be generous in sharing your provisions with them. Let's say that you brought something, one of your favorite snacks that you like, and you're on the journey. Don't go over there in the corner and eat it yourself. Share what you have with them. When they call you, answer them, right? They need you and they call you, "Hey, come over here, we need you, your help with something, to change the tire of the car that's got flat." Go over there and help them and answer them. And when they ask you for help, assist them. Try to outdo them in three things, right? Try to outdo them in three things. Long periods of silence, right? Don't just go on rambling and talking, right? If they're being silent, be quiet as well. Maybe they need to rest and they want some peace of mind, you should also be silent as well. And abundance of prayer. An abundance of prayer, it's time for namaz, it's time for salat, everybody stops to make salat, right? You also make salat and try to outdo them in making salat. And open-handedness with them with whatever you possess of riding animal, wealth, or food, right? Let's say that it's you're trying to come to a decision about whose car to take to go on the journey, right? Try to, be first to offer your car, as a means of the journey, or wealth. If you want to pool your money together to go on the journey, try to be more generous than them, pool more money than you had with them, or food, or whatever provision, other provision that's necessary for the journey. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the etiquettes of journey in the advice that Luqman gave to his son in the words of Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hussain Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.